Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
We've spoken about Bill Clinton as President Emeritus and Chief Democratic Inspirer. We've thought a little bit about Hillary Clinton, who may go down in history as the Clinton who has had the most impact on world events as Secretary of State during the Obama administration. But in some ways, the engine of the whole Clinton phenomenon in America comes from one very complex, strange, troubled, but in the end, we can say a lasting relationship.
You're looking at two people who love each other. This is not an arrangement or an understanding. This is a marriage. That's a very different thing.
You know, I'm not sitting here as some little woman standing by my man like Tammy Wynette. I'm sitting here because I love him and I respect him and I honor what he's been through and what we've been through together. And, you know, if that's not enough for people, then heck, don't vote for him.
Listen to that twang from Hillary Clinton, who grew up in suburban Chicago. Bill and Hillary there discussing their relationship on 60 Minutes back in 1992, days after the Jennifer Flowers scandal broke. A 12-year affair with then-Governor Bill Clinton was what that scandal was all about. And it was just the beginning. Aside from what Chelsea Clinton may have said to her stuffed animal toys in the White House, virtually everything about the Clinton relationship has been public from the time they both entered the public eye. William Chaff is the author of Bill and Hillary, The Politics of the Personal. He's also a professor of history at Duke University. He joins us today from the studios of MPBN in Portland, Maine. William Chaff, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So this relationship, you know, I was actually a little skeptical of this premise, but your book makes a very profound case that this is a unique relationship. It really reminds me of, Queen Victoria and Albert, in a sense. People drawn together by power and ambition, and romance is there as well. Well, what do you make of this relationship?
Well, I think it's a very good assessment you just made. I think that romance was always there. They did love each other very much, but I think there was always a sense of calculation as to whether this was the way for Hillary to go in order to make the impact she wanted to make on the world. She always saw herself as being a transformative figure. And she also knew that Bill was someone who was always going to be philandering. And yet she had to make a decision as to whether she wanted to spend her life with this person who she loved and whether that would be the best way in which together they could accomplish the goals that she had set out for herself. Or should she do this by herself? And in the end, she decided over a long period of time, this was not a quick decision. And it was one that was made with I think, some reluctance. She decided this was the way to go, and they became partners. And the implicit understanding in that partnership was that they would share not only life together but also power together.
And the theme here really is Bill Clinton, on some level, understanding his personal character limitations and Hillary Clinton understanding the limitations in the world she lived in for someone with her outsized ambition. That's a lot of wisdom for starting out in a political career for two people.
Well, it is. And I think that one of the things that's most notable about this, it comes out very clear in their experience at Yale Law School. Bill is full of affect. He's gregarious. He doesn't want to hurt anyone's feelings. He's always making friends. Hillary is direct. She's on target. She's focused. And, you know, when they do a moot court appearance at Yale Law School, he's the one who is just full of emotion and affect, and she's the one who's disciplined and hard-nosed. So ironically, in that complementary relationship, he has much of the feminine, she has much of the traditional masculine kind of approaches, but they work together beautifully to complement each other, and that complementarity is something which is an extraordinary ongoing presence in their lives.
In the White House, this relationship really inflated, enlarged, took on grander themes as Hillary aggressively took her sort of world-changing ambitions straight into the Clinton administration.
Yes, and it in some ways replicates what happened in Arkansas. When Bill lost his first re-election bid as governor, he was totally disconsolate and depressed. Hillary stepped in, took over. She created the kind of hard-nosed, disciplined, focused strategy that allowed him to get re-elected. He, in turn, made her the centerpiece of his administration, putting in charge of an education task force to deal with the most important ongoing problem in Arkansas. Well, the same kind of thing happens in 1992. Hillary Clinton rescues and saves the Clinton candidacy for president after the Jennifer Flowers episode comes out. She is totally in charge. And she knew she would be in charge. These were not new charges. These were allegations that had been made in the past. And she actually had been part of a breakfast in the previous summer with Bill Clinton, the Godfrey Sperling, the Christian Science Monitor, had on a regular basis. And at that breakfast, they raised the issue of womanizing, and she basically said the same thing she said on 60 Minutes, that she loved this man, that she was stood by him, that he was a someone who she could depend on, a strong mate, etc. Now, when Flowers comes along in January of 1992, Hillary's role really is pivotal. If she had not made that appearance saying many of the same things she said to the Godfrey Sperling breakfast, he would have been dead in the water. And yet, because of what she did, because of how she saved him, he came back, finished second in New Hampshire, and went on to win the nomination. Well, that led to a kind of almost inevitable quid pro quo. She had saved him. He now recognized the need to give her the kind of influence and power that she'd had in Arkansas, but now would become even much more official. And that becomes reflected in a whole series of steps, the most important of which probably is that she really fought against having a strong chief of staff because a strong chief of staff might have interfered with her power. She insisted on having an office in the West Wing alongside of that of Al Gore and the president. There really was a troika, a three kind of person governing structure during the first months of the presidency. Everyone had to sign off on everything. And she insisted on being the person placed in charge of the most important domestic reform Bill Clinton would be involved with, which is health care.
Lots to talk about here. Did Bill ever push back on this stuff, or could Hillary always say, hey, hey, you remember the agreement?
The bottom line is that many of Bill's closest associates had real questions about Hillary's approach to the health care issue. They brought those to the president. He seems to have appreciated the logic behind their concerns, the fact that she was not consulting with members of Congress, et cetera. And yet he could not confront and dissuade her from her position, or did not.
William Chafe, let's talk about the premise of your book, which I thought was really fascinating. You know, this sort of leftist term that came out of the 60s counter-revolution, the personal is political. I'm wondering if looking at this powerful relationship, Bill and Hillary, both in terms of how it played out in the Clinton first and second terms, did the Clintons teach America something about loyalty in Hillary's case of sticking with Bill, about sexual maturation in terms of how America responded to Bill Clinton's infantile behavior in the White House? And what do you make of the relationship today with Bill Clinton out saving the world with his Clinton Global Initiative and Hillary, Secretary of State?
Well, those are a series of really important questions. I think that Bill and Hillary were always conscious of the controversy surrounding the notion of feminism, because even though the country had come a huge distance since the 1960s, feminism remained a very controversial kind of concept. So the whole idea of a co-presidency was one that brought concern to many, many people. On the other hand, it became very clear that Hillary was going to be playing a very significant role, and in fact a dominant role, especially in the first 2 years. She was really central not only to the health care initiative, but also to a whole series of other issues that really shaped the development of those first 2 years. She was the one who decided not to have the White House press corps be admitted to the White House, but to shut the door.
And in reading your book, you describe Hillary Clinton as kind of the Dick Cheney of first ladies, taking so much power.
Well, I think that it wasn't as quite as overt as Dick Cheney, perhaps, but it was certainly there. And the Travelgate episode is one that was particularly difficult because it led to outside investigation. It put Vince Foster in a very difficult situation as he tried to disguise her role in that entire venture. And then, of course, the way in which the whole Whitewater thing played out was pivotal. And, you know, George Stephanopoulos makes the point that in December of 1993, after David Gergen had negotiated a whole agreement with the Washington Post, that they would get the Whitewater papers, they would examine them, and they would be up front and say, no criminal activity if there was no criminal activity, or they would identify where the problems were. And everyone in the White House was ready to go along with that, including the president. But Hillary Clinton said no, she would not let her papers be seen by the Washington Post. That sets in motion the process that ends up with Monica Lewinsky, because that leads to the call for an independent prosecutor. That in turn creates Ken Starr. Ken Starr in turn creates the relationship with the Lewinsky cohort, which then leads to
the leakers, the Lewinsky leakers, those
Lewinsky
characters
leakers.
Whose names were all over the news back then and who are forgotten
precisely.
To history now.
These moments make a huge difference in the end.
What did they teach us, though, about morals in America, about loyalty, about sexuality?
I think they taught us a lot about loyalty and about the difficulties and fragility, the frailty of human beings. I think one of the things that is really true about this entire period, especially once the Lewinsky scandal became public, is the American people showed an enormous tolerance for human imperfection. They responded to Bill Clinton's humanness, his frailty, his inability to keep it together. They did not respond in the kind of didactic, you've got to get out of here kind of mood. And the reason they didn't do that in part was because Hillary stood by him. She stood by him, and that made it something more. And, you know, the other thing I argue in the book at least is that that final sacrifice by Hillary in saving the president during the Lewinsky scandal is also what liberated her to become the person on her own that she became when she ran for the U.S. Senate in New York and then subsequently became Secretary of State.
You know, reading this book, I had a question over and over in my mind, and I can't answer it. I can't answer it now. I don't know if you have an answer for it, but I really get the sense that these two could not have made it on their own, that Bill Clinton without Hillary would have been kind of a Bill Richardson character, successful. He sort of would have been on the scene, but ultimately his inner demons would probably have sabotaged him. And Hillary may be too egg-headed to make it in mainstream politics. She would have been, you know, a powerful intellectual, maybe a Jean Kirkpatrick type, but not the center stage person that she is today. What do you think?
I think you're exactly right. I think I would argue that not only were they indispensable to each other, but she was more indispensable to him than he to her. I think that particularly after she does get liberated, it's her turn when she goes to the Senate, et cetera. I believe that now she could function on her own. But all the way through that, I'm not sure she would have gotten to where she. I mean, you know, Betsy Wright, her best friend, when she was working on the McGovern campaign in Texas in 1972, said, "You know, you're going to be the first woman president, and you have all the capacity to just do it all on your own." And it was Hillary's decision that maybe she couldn't do that. That's why she got married to Bill. Now I think she is really an independent person. He is too, to some extent. I thought the kind of extraordinary speech he made last night shows the degree to which he is a figure in his own right, as she is a figure in her own right. But they would not have gotten to where they are without each other.
Is there peace in our time in the Clinton household? Have they agreed to disagree, to be who they are? Or will it end up like Tipper Gore and Al Gore?
You know, that is a $64,000 question. And if I had an answer to that, I would be someone other than who I am.
We should be grateful for this relationship, though, politically, at least.
Absolutely.
That's the lesson from your book.
Yes, I think so.
Did you think you would say that going into this project?
You know, I think that one of the things you do when you start writing a book is you don't ever quite know what you're going to decide. And as I wrote this book, I at different points disliked either of them or both of them. But in the end, I came to have a real strong sense of empathy and support and recognition of all that they created for the country.
Well, it's a great filter for looking back on events that probably are very familiar, some of which would need to be we need to be reminded of, I think, thinking about this election cycle. William Chafe is the author of Bill and Hillary, The Politics of the Personal. He's a professor of history at Duke University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So, Washington is a city divided by Republicans and Democrats, as you know, but on the football field yesterday, it was the Cowboys versus the Giants game, competing with what was going on down in Charlotte. Who won out in your house? Was it a competition? Did you watch the speeches last night from the DNC or the game? An Arlington, Massachusetts listener says, football, Democrats and GOP represent the 1%, not me. I also want to see if replacement refs are a train wreck. That's a serious issue. And JC from Atlanta writes, the NFL season is just starting, but with 60 days until the election, the RNC versus the DNC is in full combat mode. I guess that's like the Super Bowl. No, the debates will be more like the Super Bowl for this long, long presidential contest. Tell us what you think. Go to Facebook.com/The Takeaway or call 877-8MY-TAKE. Our coverage continues tomorrow. A wrap-up of tonight's Big Gun, the president speaking at the convention. Head over to Facebook. Tell us what you want to hear from the president. Post at Facebook.com/The Takeaway. We'll recap what you heard, what you didn't hear on tomorrow's program. I'm John Hockenberry. There's your takeaway.